It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we meet a behavioral ecologist who researches why mammals make the decisions they do. And our first animal behavior class is underway at UW-Eau Claire with study subjects like dogs, Madagascar hissing cockroaches, and crawfish. Call in with questions and comments about animal behavior, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jen Smith is an assistant professor of biology at UW-Eau Claire. Jen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
What questions are your students most interested in answering about animal behavior?
That is the question of the day. So they're very, very interested in trying to figure out the hidden worlds of animals. And they generally use two different approaches. They're trying to understand how different types of behaviors work and also why animals do what they do in an evolutionary sense.
How complex are animals' thoughts and you know, what they do, when they do it? What is instinct? What is their own thinking and reasoning?
Right. And that is something that we wrestle with a lot at the beginning of this course. So, the animal behavior course has not been taught for quite some time at UW-Eau Claire. And so we started off the semester thinking about nature versus nurture. And actually, through their projects on dogs, they discovered that it's a combination of these two things. So there are various aspects of behavior that are certainly learned and develop across a lifespan. But there are also differences based on selective breeding, artificial breeding that humans have imposed upon these animals. And so we see different breed types behaving differently as well.
What are some of the experiments that you're able to do with the students that are able to lead them into this balance of nature versus nurture?
Right. So recently we went to Embark, which is a dog training facility that's right here in Eau Claire. And the students went, we brought community members in. There were dogs from all over the town, and they came in, and the researchers, which are our students, were doing these experiments based on dogs are motivated by food. I think we all like to eat, and dogs included. And we asked whether the dogs could understand human pointing. So it's a pretty simple test. show them food, get them understanding where to go and search for this hidden treat in a bucket. And then we ratchet it up so it gets more and more complicated, and then eventually ask, in the absence of seeing where the food goes, are the dogs able to understand human social pointing? And many of them do.
And they have such persistence in accomplishing something. Sometimes I just marvel at their focus. Where does that come from?
Absolutely. One of the things that we discovered in this work is that some dogs have a lot more focus than others. And we really, and I think that's generally, this is happening with these dogs. It's a major theme in my research studies out in nature on squirrels and other kinds of animals as well, where these individual differences emerge. So from animal behavior perspective, rather than it being noise, we're incredibly interested in explaining what is it about the life experience of an individual animal? What is it about how they've been, over evolutionary time favored to do certain things? And it comes back to this nature versus nurture combination oftentimes.
We're talking about animal behavior with Jen Smith, assistant professor and behavioral ecologist at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in with your questions and comments about animal behavior and what you wonder. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jen, in people, trauma at a young age, it increases the risk of adverse effects later in life. How well does research of mammal behavior help better understand what people go through?
It helps us a lot. So people are long-lived. We're challenging to study, and sometimes it's, you know, not ethical to ask certain questions. As a behavioral ecologist, we can actually go and look at many, many different animals all at once experiencing many different types of factors. So we saw in the dog study some differences in terms of raising environment, whether dogs were rescued and grew up, you know, without exposure to humans compared to those that are experiencing a consistent home. And, you know, that can influence the outcomes of some of these tests. We also see a lot of this in my squirrel research out in California, where squirrels that are growing up in an area where they're exposed to humans early in life are incredibly different later in life than those that are in a more pristine or natural situation. And this has implications for thinking about the life course and how many of these animals are resilient. They'll actually shift their behavioral decisions based on what they experience early in life. So it used to be thought that exposure to adversity is harmful, but actually we're seeing, I mean, of course it is in the short term, but our research across social mammals has really shown that there are many ways that animals, including ourselves, can be resilient and shift how we approach the world based on these early experiences. It's a little bit more of an optimistic understanding of the phenomenon than we originally thought.
Well, of course, resilience and grit are those types of characteristics that we really strive for as humans. I'm wondering, when you look at that resilience, how does animal behavior shift when there's like overpopulation or habitat loss or climate change? Does that affect animal behavior and decision making?
Absolutely. One issue that's out there is whether animals that have these behaviors that have a genetic basis, so there's a genetic basis, and natural selection over millions of years has favored these particular ways that animals behave. And when humans impose new novel constraints in the environment, one challenge for animals is to be able to keep up. And sometimes they're unable to just through natural selection change what they're doing, but behavioral flexibility, that grit, being able to shift on a dime or with new circumstances, really creates some opportunities for some species, and other species are more harmed, I think, by these rapid shifts.
I want to return to the dogs for just a moment and talk a bit more about, you know, a dog's breed. Does a dog's breed change its behavior, and how so? What do you see?
The students have found that a dog's breed is one of the clearest signals in influencing their ability to communicate with humans and to solve problems. What we're finding is that working dogs, dogs that have been favored to, you know, do a task in coordination with humans, those are the dogs that tend to do really, really well at understanding human social cues. Toy dogs, we can pick them up, we can, you know, carry them around and so forth. And as adorable as they are, they're not quite as good at looking at these human cues as are the herding dogs or the working dogs.
There's human cues, and then I'm wondering the cues from other dogs. Like how, you know, do the studies reveal like how they deal with unequal rewards when one dog gets more than another, or how dogs cooperate with each other to work together? What do you see there?
That is an excellent question. This is not my work, but people have certainly looked at inequity aversion. So whether dogs respond negatively if one dog gets more of a treat than another, and they absolutely do. There are very few species out there where people have documented this phenomenon of understanding whether things are equal or not. And dogs 100% do. They're very tuned in to the worlds of their fellow canine companions. They also make decisions on how much humans share with others. So think of yourself, maybe you're at the kitchen table right now, enjoying a bowl of cereal. One person might be generous and sharing food with other humans. The other person may be less likely to drop food on the ground and whatnot. And it turns out that dogs, through careful experimental tests, can eavesdrop on how generous humans are to each other and make decisions to, you know, go over to the person that's going to share food potentially with another human and make the leap that it's going to also get food given to itself.
Wow, that is complex. There is strategy there. UW Eau Claire behavioral ecologist and evolutionary biologist Jen Smith here studies the decision-making of social mammals. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the social lives of mammals, their structures, how it informs human systems. A new animal behavior course underway at UW Eau Claire. Call in with questions about the social lives of animals, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jen Smith is an assistant professor of biology and a behavioral ecologist at UW Eau Claire. Jen, your students are studying inequality in social mammals. Help us understand that. What types of inequality exist among social mammals?
Right. That is a great question. And one of the things we're doing is we're looking across lots and lots of species of mammals. So if they're social, that means that they're spending time together, repeated interactions with each other. And some animals are more equitable in sharing than others. One of the phenomena that we've been studying is privilege and trying to think about the ways that non-human animals will preferentially privilege some individuals over others. And we're looking at these commodities, so something outside of the body of an animal that can be transferred from one generation to another. So for example, red squirrels up in Alaska, they have these big middens where they put many, many, many pine cones together. And a mother will generate this large stack of pine cones, this resource, this wealth, and she'll actually transfer it to some squirrel offspring, but not others.
Wow.
And that, yeah, it influences their survival, their reproduction, all of these commodities that are really important for evolutionary outcomes.
And that those differences in intergenerational wealth, you know, for social animals, it's so interesting. It can be many different things. I mean, there was one study that looked at the passing on tools for cracking nuts and what that can mean for offspring and future generations. Can you, you know, we're also looking that in the human world very seriously. Where are the parallels?
There are very striking parallels. And in fact, the work that we're doing was motivated by ways that anthropologists have studied human societies and the way that wealth can be transferred. And we use that exact same lens for thinking about, okay, do we actually see physical commodities being transferred one generation to another? Do we see social wealth being transferred? And in human societies, social networks are one of the strongest predictors of health outcomes. So having a tight social network, having support systems are incredibly important in humans. And it turns out in non-human animals, this is true as well.
how do you, or if you can guess, how do animals react to this inequality? Do they understand their place, so to speak, or do they notice it?
Well, one of the pieces that we're working on right now, we're creating this whole special issue with Philosophical Transactions, Royal Society B, and we're looking at inequality. And the paper that I'm working on with UW Claire students is to actually look at the balance between equality and inequality and mechanisms that animals use to promote equality in these situations that might be viewed as unequal. And they do a lot of different mechanisms. So they have peacekeeping. So if they have a fight, many animals will make up. They, you know, chimpanzees will kiss each other, bonobos, which are related to us as well, other apes, they hug after a fight. Even the dogs that we were just talking about, they have various ways of making up to repair relationships. So if there is something unequal, they have ways to level that in the long run and promote sharing.
Talking with Jen Smith, assistant professor and behavioral ecologist at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in with your questions about animal behavior, 800-642-1234. Tyler wrote to ask, three-year-old corgi and a five-year-old cat's their best friends, and the cat, who tends to push things off the counter for attention, seems to have figured out which thing is a dog treat box. And Tyler has discovered multiple times pushing the cat pushing the box off the counter, causing it to crash, opening up, spilling treats over the ground, and is wondering, do you think it's possible the cat is working with Finley to take control of the food supplies?
Oh, Tyler, that is amazing. And Finley, well done. That is incredible. So absolutely, these partnerships between members of different species are by no means limited just to humans and our pets, but pets can actually establish relationships with one another. And there are even some, small lines of evidence that domesticated pets can form relationships with wild animals as well. Somewhat dangerous encounters between large cats, so a little bit larger than the cat you're describing, like lions, can actually form partnerships with domestic dogs out in, for example, Kenya, where I did my PhD work. So I think these sort of trickster collaborations are pretty interesting. Are pets at home, like humans, maybe, you know, we were locked down during early COVID days, can get bored. And so they innovate, they have different ways that they can create a more stimulating environment. And it sounds like by by doing this, they you know, it's a win-win. And I'm sure the dog is really excited to have this feeding opportunity.
Well, I think we're getting to your favorite part of the conversation, which is squirrels, because you're a leader in ground squirrel research. What can you tell us about your long-term studies of California ground squirrels?
Oh, gosh. So every summer, I bring students to Briones Regional Park, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And yeah, we've been doing this long-term study for the last decade on individually marked squirrels and are looking at their personalities, their social networks, the ways that they throw dirt and form coalitions against rattlesnakes. And they're just such incredible, bold animals. And kind of going back to what we started with, this idea about, you know, ways humans are influencing various species. I think squirrels, because of their adaptability, their flexibility, they're one of the species that are actually doing pretty well in the face of humans.
At the end of the semester, you're bringing students to California. What will the students be researching about ground squirrels?
They'll be doing some of the baseline data collection, which is monitoring who the moms, the dads are, marking the young of the year. So they'll be doing that piece, and then they'll be adding a new piece to the project, which is to see how well these squirrels can solve a puzzle box. The puzzle box is a touchscreen computer, and we train one squirrel to be able to figure out the puzzle. If they do it, they get a food item, major theme for today. And we're then asking whether the idea of solving that puzzle can be transferred by observing a really smart squirrel solving that puzzle, and whether that varies based on if the squirrels are exposed to humans or if they're in a more naturalistic setting.
Wow. Jen, thank you for joining us and sharing your research.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Jen Smith is an assistant professor of biology at UW-Eau Claire. Research aims to understand decision-making in social mammals. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.